seated, please.
The court is now ready to hear argument in 070131, John Christopher Franca, M.D. and others versus Stacy Velasquez and others.
May it please the court, Mr. Crofts will present argument on behalf of the petitioners. The petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This case concerns one of six election of remedy provisions that were added to the Texas Tort Claims Act in 2003. They're found in Section 101.106 in the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code. Three of these six provisions simply expand on the concept that was already there in the election of remedies provision before 2003, in that they provide that pursuit of a claim against the government is going to foreclose pursuit of a claim against the employee involving the same subject matter. The other three add something new to the election of remedies concept in that they are triggered by claims against the employee rather than claims against the government. Two of them simply provide new defenses for the government. For example, one of the provisions is that a judgment against the employee forecloses suit against the employer for the same subject matter. Another of them even provides that a suit against the employee is an irrevocable election of any and forecloses a claim against the employer unless the employer consents. Well, that's a kicker on that one, which gets me to the one that this case is about, 101-106F, because it does provide that in a suit brought against an employee, that the government does consent under certain circumstances for the employer to be substituted for that employee as a defendant in the case.
And that's typically when the employee acts in an official capacity. Now, when you've got a doctor practicing medicine who is accused of not using good, sound medical judgment, how do you square that with acting in an official capacity or performing a governmental function?
Your Honor, I think in the context of common law official capacity, the court has held in the Kasson case that practicing medicine is not a governmental function, and that unless the doctor is involved in something really governmental, the common law doctrine of official immunity is not available in that context.
Does paragraph F reverse Kasson?
No, sir, I don't think it does, because it is not necessarily official immunity as contemplated by the origin of official immunity, which is kind of a derivative of sovereign immunity.
But F seems to say if the doctor's on the job, he's got sovereign immunity.
He's got some kind of immunity. I don't know that it would be properly categorized as sovereign immunity.
Why isn't it sovereign? Because it's in the employee's official capacity only.
I think because sovereign involves a jurisdictional concept. I think election of remedies is more of a defense. I think they're very close. I think they're very related, and I think it's certainly arguable.
If he is only sued in his official capacity, doesn't he have governmental, isn't it the suit is against the government and he has immunity?
Under the statute? If it's a suit in the course of his employment and it's a suit that could have been brought against the government, then it provides a statutory immunity. I think a problem with saying it's sovereign immunity, Your Honor, is that a condition to that immunity being there is that there is an action available against the employer, the state employer. And if there's an action available against the state employer, there wouldn't be sovereign immunity. And this figures into how the element in this statute that requires, because for this statute, statutory immunity to be available to the employee, according to the statute, it's got to be shown by some degree that the suit could have been brought against the government. Well, all the cases Court of Appeals cases dealing with what this statute means when it says could have been brought against the employer, basically uniformly, I don't know that there's one that says anything other than this, there has to be a showing that the employer government's immunity was waived in order for this immunity to be available to the employee. So I think it would be a strange thing if this were the employee's immunity were equated to sovereign immunity in a situation under the same facts when the government didn't have sovereign immunity.
Well, I'm not sure I understood. So your position is that F applies, this phrase that we're worrying about, could have been brought under this chapter, means successfully brought under the chapter.
That gets to the heart of our question about what that means and what is the review process and what is the standard standard for deciding when is it, what is necessary to show that it could have been brought against the government. And keep in mind, this is a pretrial procedure. The cases that hold, there needs to be a showing that there were of circumstances under which the employer government's immunity would be waived in order for this to be available. The statute just says motion to dismiss. The question is what is the standard? What does the moving employee have to show in order to get this immunity in this pretrial setting? Some cases have said, analogizing it to other motions to dismiss contexts like arbitration and like the expert report, and said, oh, it's just abuse of discretion. Others say it's so much like a plea to the jurisdiction by the government, especially because they all latch themselves to the idea of there must be, in order for it to be something that could have been brought, there's got to be a waiver of immunity. That's wrapped into the statute through the Court of Appeals decisions. So our position is that, and this is supported by the Phillips versus DeFonte case that we've cited, that borrowing from this context of plea to the jurisdiction, that a process similar to the court's analyses of pleas to the jurisdiction when a claimant is suing the government, as discussed in the Miranda case and others of this court, if the movement can have put on evidence that if true, would defeat a hypothetical plea to the jurisdiction by the government. And this wraps this statutory proceeding not really into a jurisdictional thing. I don't think it's a jurisdictional thing about the employee. I think it's just a statutory defense.
So the question would be if the plaintiff, if we just imagine a circumstance where the plaintiff sued not the doctors, but the hospital, and do we do this mental exercise? If the hospital then filed a plea to the jurisdiction, would it be successful based on the pleadings and the evidence that the employees have presented in this case?
That's correct. That's our position. I think that's supported by the Phillips case. And in our case,
that doesn't go to whether the plaintiff would win the case, but whether a plea to the jurisdiction would survive.
That's right.
So, counsel, under your scenario, the burden is on the employee of the state to show that the state has liability, and so the burden's on the plaintiff to show the state doesn't have liability. We just flip all of the burdens here.
Well, that's a funny thing about the statute, Your Honor. And I mean,
that has to be your position.
It has to be our position, but I don't know that it's show liability. I think following the Miranda sort of analysis of is there something that would defeat a plea to the jurisdiction before trial, especially when it is a fact that really merges with the merits, if there's something that would, in this hypothetical suit against the government, preclude a dismissal from one of jurisdiction by the employer, then the movement has shown that it could have been brought.
So the government employee is going to come in and testify against the government?
Well, the government, I don't know that the government employee has to do that in every case. In our case, the government employee has presented, in support of a motion for summary judgment, an expert report of the plaintiff, and keep in mind this all goes up to, this could have been brought in a hypothetical beating a pretrial plea to the jurisdiction by the government involves the waiver of immunity, and in our case, injury caused by tangible property. And so we, as movements for summary judgment under this statute, relied on the plaintiff's expert report, which contains an opinion that the use of a vacuum extractor in the birth of this child increased the risk of the shoulder dystocia, which was the injury that the child suffered during birth.
If there had been no allegation, take the vacuum extractor out of the case, then you'd agree that the suit could not have been brought against the government.
Well, that's the most use of tangible property that we have in the case, and so I agree. Yes.
Okay. So why can't we parse between those? That to the extent the claim is based on the vacuum extractor, then the employee, the employer is substituted in for the employee on those claims. But as to the medical judgment claims, where the doctors did not act in an official capacity, those can go forward. That's what the Court of Appeals seemed to differentiate between.
Your Honor, I think there would be problems splitting a cause of action there. I think this court's jurisdiction...
Well, it's not splitting a cause of action. It's two separate causes of action, one in official capacity, one not in official capacity.
Well, I think the question is, could the suit that's been brought have been brought? That's the statutory language. Could the suit that's been brought have been...
But we're going in circles because if the doctors were not acting in an official capacity, you agree... It could not have been brought against the employer.
Well, but here we have evidence that there was use of tangible property that caused the injury.
So you don't think someone can act partially in an official capacity and partially not in official capacity?
Well, I'm not sure that I would say that, but I would say under this court's jurisprudence dealing with pleas to the jurisdiction and governmental immunity, that parsing is not done. If it's a suit against a governmental entity for which immunity is waived by virtue of tangible property being a cause of the event, that doesn't mean that the court only has jurisdiction of that particular thing. I think the court's decisions are... that if there are other alleged events that participate in the cause, they're also subject to...
So the question is, what if they're not alleged? Are you saying that the government can make up a claim that the plaintiff has not asserted, and this made-up claim could have been brought against the government even though the plaintiff never asserted, and therefore the plaintiff's case is dismissed?
No, sir. I think it has to be within the plaintiff's case. I don't think it has to be...
Not their pleadings, but their case.
Correct. I don't think it has to be within their pleadings. I think, and I think the court said this in Miranda.
But if they don't have to plead it, who's going to decide, well, you know, aren't you saying that the government can come in and say, we think they should have pled a different claim that we would have been immune for and therefore dismiss the one they actually pled?
Well, not the government, but the employee who they sued. Yes, sir. Because... I think that
so if an employee is driving a government vehicle and commits a drive-by shooting, which is there's no waiver for that in the statute, the government could say, well, they should have said this was used operation of a motor vehicle and get the whole thing dismissed, even though that's a crazy claim and not one the plaintiffs made. And we have to dismiss it because we can imagine somebody might have pled something that might have come under the Tort Claims Act?
I think under this court's decisions dealing with pleas to the jurisdiction, the court looks to the substance of the claim, and it's not necessarily tied to the language used in a petition. And certainly there are cases in which are so extreme that that's not going to work. But in cases like this one, It does, because the plaintiff's suit is based on negligence of these two physicians occurring in the birth of their child. And if they don't plead the vacuum extractor as a cause, I think it's perfectly legitimate for the moving employee to come in and say, well, here are the circumstances.
If the plaintiffs want to drop their good claim, if you're right that the vacuum extractor and use of tangible property is their good claim, if the plaintiffs want to drop that, say, look, we'll just go forward with our weak claims that we're more likely to lose on, what does the employees, why would the employees object to that? Just because they, under your theory, they can get rid of the whole thing anyway, the good and the bad claims.
Well, I think in a case like this, when the facts are what they are, and especially when their own expert states in his report and his disclosure that the use of a vacuum extractor did increase the risk of this injury.
But apparently the evidence showed it caused injury simply to the head, and that what happened after the use of the vacuum extractor is what caused the damage that's being sued for in the case.
Well, that's one version, and it is true that the vacuum extractor contact with the scalp only caused a minor injury, but their expert says, and this is his opinion, that the use of the vacuum extractor increased the risk of this kind of injury occurring, and also says that that should have been recognized by the doctors, and based on that recognition, they should never have even undertaken a vaginal. Is my time up?
Yes. Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument now from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Haygood will present arguments for the respondent.
May it please the court. There is one thing among many others that are that is indisputable in this case. Pardon me. And that is that the procedural vehicle chosen by the doctors to pursue this immunity issue is a summary judgment proceeding. The briefing confirms that the summary judgment was filed intentionally for some appellate strategic purpose that, quite candidly, I'm not very clear. But be that as it may, in a summary judgment proceeding, rules are very clear. Texas Rule of Civil Procedure says that a summary judgment is to be granted unless there is a genuine issue of material fact. Case law requires.
The statute just could have been brought. It doesn't say could have, will win. I mean, if this was a car wreck case and you bring it against the government agency employee driver, and it's a swearing light red light swearing match, and so you say, well, this could have been brought against the employer, which it surely could have been. You don't have to prove you were going to win. You don't have to prove who actually had the red light.
There is a continuum, Judge, that could have been brought, has been discussed. The doctors have even suggested that could have been brought means could have been initiated. Well, we know that that cannot be true.
That could be anything.
That would be so far on the continuum end that it's not.
But doesn't it mean could have been brought, if at all?
No. I think what it means is this. When you look at the immunity cases, there are, in my judgment, at least in, to the extent that we're involved with here, you can have an immunity claim be brought by the defendant governmental entity saying that the Tort Claims Act did not waive our right to immunity in this situation. If that is brought, the case law, Miranda and others, are very clear that if the defendant must prove entitlement to immunity to the extent that there is no fact issue against it. Said another way, if the plaintiff produces a fact issue Immunity cannot be granted, and the case cannot be dismissed.
Well, if we construed paragraph E in Mission just a few months ago, right?
In Mission.
And we said, question was, what does filed under the under this chapter mean?
Yes, sir.
And we basically said if it's a tort claim, it's filed under this chapter.
I think you broadened it to any tort claim and conceivable.
And why wouldn't we read it the same way in F, the very next paragraph?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the.
Well, the, E says a suit filed under this chapter, and F says a suit that could have been brought under this chapter.
Oh, I understand.
Why wouldn't we read F the same way we read E just the other day?
Well, and I think you're certainly entitled to, but what one of the things you've asked us to.
I understand we're entitled to, but I mean, what?
Judge, I'm sorry, it wasn't
but
intended.
Why would we or wouldn't or shouldn't we? Why should we or shouldn't we?
Well, I think we're talking about apples and oranges here, and let me suggest where my thought is, and perhaps this will answer your question. If an individual doctor in this case wants to take advantage of subsection F, all he has to do is claim immunity.
Officially,
now then the question comes...
What kind of immunity does he claim?
You mean, well, I heard the discussion here. Judge, honestly, I don't know if it's sovereign immunity or what. I consider it to be official immunity because it's an individual and not a sovereign subdivision of the state. That's the way I see it. But from a plaintiff standpoint, and I'm sorry to get right down on the mat about it, I don't like immunity under any name. So regardless of what it is, it still kicks my client out of court.
But it seems to me it makes a big difference here because F seems to define when you're acting in an individual capacity and when you're acting in a governmental capacity.
I think that's absolutely true.
And in Kasson, we said doctors basically don't act in their governmental capacity.
That is correct.
They're setting the budget, or if they're doing something for the hospital, maybe so. But when they're working on patients, that's in their individual capacity.
That is correct.
Reading of Kasson.
Yes, sir.
And does this restructure that and say basically you don't have an individual capacity anymore?
Judge, It very well may, because what we've done now is give the doctors a statutory immunity, if you will, by only claiming that, hey, I'm an employee basically in the course and scope, and this lawsuit could have been brought under the Tort Claims Act. So that's a statutory immunity that is different than the other immunities that at least I have read in conjunction with this case. But the standard, regardless of what you call it, the standard in my mind is the same. If this subsection F is constitutional, allows a new statutory immunity for doctors, if that is allowed, which apparently it is, the burden that the doctors have should be, in my mind, exactly the same burden that the government has when it asserts immunity at the beginning of the lawsuit in the previous example that I suggested, and that is you've got to prove it basically as a matter of law, meaning that if I raise a fact issue or the plaintiff raises a fact issue, you cannot then grant dismissal for the doctor.
I understand that, but... Let me ask a question this way.
Yes, sir.
Could the plaintiffs in this case have, without regard to the doctor, could they have sued the hospital directly in this case?
Judge, could I have sued them? Yes. Would I have sued them? Absolutely not.
So we're trying to, you know, it's a struggle here. What does it mean to say could have been brought? It doesn't say that you have to conclusively establish liability. It's a hypothetical. Could they have brought this suit against the hospital and survived a plea to the jurisdiction from the hospital?
That is exactly right. In my mind, what could have been brought means it has to be commensurate with the burden of proof in the issue. Does it have to be conclusively 100% proven, or is it simply just that you can file a lawsuit if you have $150 and the guts to do it? It simply means that if the plaintiff can produce a fact issue, then the suit could not have been brought under 101-106F. To me, it's got to be that, or otherwise, you've got inconsistent burdens, you've got inconsistent definitions. It can't be anything else.
But Counsel, you're saying if the plaintiff produces a fact issue as to whether it could or could not have been brought.
Absolutely.
Okay, so the plaintiff's position, we couldn't have brought it, you get past summary judgment.
That is exactly right, Judge. And along those lines, there
but here
is.
That's a legal question.
I'm sorry?
Here, that's a legal question.
It's absolutely.
It's not really a factual one. It's would the use of this tangible piece of property in this case, would it permit a lawsuit against the hospital, or would it preclude it because it's not the kind of use and or there's no causation or something?
Judge, I think that's exactly right. I think that, and to get right down to it, I think that this issue is a question of law. I don't think, and it allows appellate courts a de novo review. I know those were a couple of the issues that the court wanted us to brief. That's the bottom line of those.
How this tangible property was used is a fact question. Argument among the doctors whether it caused the injury or not.
Well, right? If the court will remember, under the risk utility test in determining whether there is a duty, there are fact issues that are decided and that are presented to the court to determine whether, as a matter of law, based on these facts, there is a duty.
So,
and duty is a question of law, too. So I agree with you. There are factual determinations to be made, but they're made to allow a court, whether it's trial court or appellate court, to make the decision as a matter of law whether immunity exists or not.
So you have to have a trial to determine whether the hospital is immune or not.
I'm sorry, sir.
Don't you have to have a trial on that fact question to determine whether the hospital is immune or not?
Well, therein is where you must decide what the procedural vehicle is to present it. The defendants in this case sought it by way of motion for summary judgment. In the Tejada case and in the, the other case had found that the defendants had sustained their burden. Both those cases apparently were motions to dismiss.
Well, let me, and maybe I may not understand this exactly, but just summarizing the other side's point, you don't lose anything permanently. If they're right, the governmental unit subs in, and as the defendant, and the plaintiff pursues the case there, and if, as that case proceeds, it's determined that, in fact, the government is immune, then the case continues against the doctors, so that you don't. I mean, there's sort of a test trial. So, if in fact the government is not immune and the suit could have been brought, that's where your lawsuit goes. If factually or legally it's determined it could not have been brought, then it returns to the plaintiff. What's your answer to that scenario?
Yes, sir. I've got some very significant. I've got some very definite thoughts about that. I read the briefing that suggests that the plaintiff, hey, you're in great shape because you have all these potential appeals and if things go exactly right. Judge, I wish I could tell you that every time I step into a trial court, everything's going to go exactly right. It doesn't. For instance, they suggest that because this is not a final judgment, if the trial court dismisses or grants the immunity and then I've got to dismiss and bring in the hospital, that's not a final judgment. Well, I think Mr. Cross or one of his trial counsel convinced a trial court to sever that kind of situation to where the decision was final. All of a sudden, now I'm on appeal with a record that I may not be able to prevail. How do we know that's not going to happen?
Is it your view of how this statute works that having chosen to file to sue the employee, B now prohibits you from suing the government, subject to F?
Well, let me bring up the Briggs case to answer that question. And, Justice Heck, with your permission, may I add, yes, add one more comment to this? Judge, we also have to now be aware, and it's a very, very scary thing for me, of the Briggs decision and the Calderon decision. And I apologize, I'm not sure which one it is, or maybe both. But what those cases, or at least one of those cases, held is this. Said, look, you're entitled, Mr. Plaintiff, you're entitled to the protection of subsection F, but you have to comply exactly with subsection F. And if you contest this, as we have through today, you have blown that 30-day window for dismissing and refiling. And although you may think you're right, and although you may have a judge and appellate court say you're right, if you end up being wrong at the end of the case, you have not complied with F. Therefore, B applies, and you're out. But that's the holding of those two, or at least one or both of those two cases.
But apart from that, apart from the 30-day problem.
Yes, sir.
You do think that you're out under B unless you can invoke it.
Oh, Judge, absolutely. Yes, sir.
So B, you've already made an election under B, and now the question is, does F save you or apply?
That is exactly right, or the other way, but it amounts to the same thing. That's exactly right.
You know, this was part of a package of legislation.
Yes, sir, it was.
What I'm wondering is, if you're right, how does this really change anything? Because the plaintiff could always sue the employee in his individual capacity. And if the employee was a professional, like a physician, under Kasson, he'd have a pretty good shot at recovery against the individual. And then you'd have the Chapter 102 and 104 triggering indemnity, probably, and you'd get to recovery the same way.
Judge, I'm sorry. I think it changes everything. From me as a lawyer, I mean, Judge Brister, I think you talked about you don't know what it's like to be a judge. With me as a lawyer sitting in my desk looking at 101, going, oh my God, if I mess up on this, I better contact my malpractice carrier. And this court and others have made it very, very clear that the burden is on me and others that bring these lawsuits to make sure we know before we step into a Texas Tort Claims Act case to know. So does it change everything? Oh, absolutely. It changes everything. Now, is there a potential under subsection F to allow us to bring suit against the employee and then, you know, test the waters? Yes, there is, Judge, there is. But it's about that much. And anybody that does that, from my standpoint, is seriously walking on the edge, if not jumping over.
Does that mean that the legislative purpose in F was to provide a strong incentive to sue the government and not its employees?
I think the legislative purpose was exactly what the courts have said in Mission and otherwise, and that is to reduce reduce the burden of lawsuits against improper defendants to kind of figure out who's doing what, where, and when that would have been on the defendants, and put the burden, shift the burden to us to be very, very careful with what we do. And that's what I've done in this case, Judge.
I was trying to look at the bottom line, because okay, if you sued a government employee physician,
okay,
in his official capacity and his individual capacity.
Yes, sir.
On the first one, you're going to be met with sovereign immunity.
Absolutely.
So that gives you a shot at the second one, and you can only be met with official immunity. And Kasson says, well, you don't really have official immunity except in very limited circumstances.
Correct.
So you're basically reduced to just suing an ordinary person. And if you win, You've got the indemnity provisions of the remedies code that says that basically the government is going to come in and indemnify its employees under any
whatever
reasonable circumstances.
Yes.
I'm wondering if F meant to take that official immunity route off the table by sort of redefining official immunity here, or individual capacity.
Judge, I apologize. It sounds like that's a similar question that you had asked me before, and I'm not sure that I can give you any better answer, and I apologize to you. I'm just,
I mean, it's
just not that smart enough, I guess.
It's troubling, and if it does, it's a very radical, change.
Judge, I've seen it as as you have, a very radical change. But I've seen it as now there's another pitfall for plaintiffs in bringing lawsuits that wasn't otherwise there. And the stated purpose may be very, very correct. And it obviously has produced those results, what the legislature wanted. But to get into the minute, and I don't, my comment isn't meant to be demeaning, of course, but to get into the minutia of, you know, does it change the official immunity issue and that thing, I honestly, my thought process has not gone there.
Is there much legislative history on this?
No, I'm sorry. I was going somewhere else. No, I have not found any legislative history on that. What I thought you were asking is, since the Franca versus Velasquez case has been decided, what are the cases? There are 27 cases since that time that have discussed in some form or fashion the 101-106F provision. Judge, in the 15 seconds that I have left, may I make one comment? I don't believe in the judicial environment that exists today there would be any chance in the world that this case, based on, even if you accept the strength of Dr. Halbridge's report, would be decided where there would be, that would be a tangible use of, or a use of tangible personal property. And here's the reason. If you look at Dr. Halbridge's report, not the defendant's suggestion of what it says, but his report, all he does is identify this as a risk factor among five other risk factors. Period, paragraph, that's it. Justice O'Neill, you acknowledge that there is not any evidence that this caused or was an actual cause of it per the rules, but per the law. But one thing that is important, a risk factor does nothing more than provide or say that there are certain conditions that make an injury possible. Risk factors are nothing more than conditions that make an injury possible. And I remember sitting, you can believe it or not, but it's the truth. I remember sitting, reading this court's decision some time ago where you said conditions that make an injury possible do not equate to use. And I'm going, what the heck does that mean? Well, 15 years later or so, now we've got one, or at least it's very clear to me. Judges, thank you so much for your time.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Yes.
Do you mind addressing counsel's last comment about these risk factors and how they're perhaps just something to be considered and are not the cause of this injury, and therefore you don't fall under protections?
I think that's a characterization from one side of the evidence in this case, Your Honor. I don't know that there's an, as a matter of law, answer to that question. There's more in this report of Dr. Halbridge than the mere fact that here is a list of risk factors. He specifically said that these risk factors should have been recognized, and had they been recognized, the whole vaginal process would not have occurred the use of the vacuum extractor would not have occurred. There would have been a cesarean section. But I think more importantly, he explicitly says that the use of a vacuum extractor increased the risk of this kind of injury occurring. And I think that's some evidence that the use of that tangible property was a cause.
Counsel, it seems like a lot of times in medical malpractice cases, if you have an empty chair, that becomes a pretty big part of a trial. And just following conceptually where you're headed on this, if the statute pushes the plaintiff into a questionable or marginal, even if they get past summary judgment and get to causation there, you have a vacuum extractor that played some part, and you're suing and you're talking to a jury, but you have these physicians who were in there manipulating the child and everything else. Seems like the statute might actually be affecting the merits of a claim where there's an injury and there may be several causes, but you're going to have to push the plaintiff to try that on a marginal cause when, and just cutting out a significant defendant or defendants in there. Is that somehow, is that the goal of the statute here, or what? Does that play any part in your analysis?
Well, I think on the subject of the goal of the statute, there's, of course, a lot of legislative history about the 2003 statutes, and this I've read as much as I can read, and there's more than I can read about the testimony and the and so forth about the views that led to the tort reform legislation in 2003. One comment about 101-106F that is reported in the legislative history of House Bill 4 is that this statute, the goal of this statute is to eliminate suits against employees in situations where they suit could have been brought against the employer, and the testimony was from a Texas departmental agency saying our employees are being subjected to these suits and we don't want that to take place anymore, and that figured into the policy that led to this legislation. But Your Honor, I don't think the statute answers the question that you're really concerned about, and I can see it being a concern. Our position is just trying to figure out how this statute ought to work. And the statute says...
The legislature's told us their statutes are to be construed to reach a reasonable and just result.
Of course.
If you have an injury caused, say, 80% by manipulation, let's assume 80% by manipulation, or 90%, or 95%, and a small percentage by this vacuum extractor. When you start trying to get a jury to pin it all on the vacuum extractor, sometimes as a plaintiff you have a difficulty, although there's no question that, let's assume again, no question that there was fault somewhere. So it's somehow hard to see that reaching a reasonable and just result by the statutory language if we interpret it that way.
Well, Your Honor, I think you have the same problem in suits against the government in which there are multiple features in the factual circumstances that contribute to the cause. One or more of them may have to do with motor-driven equipment. One or more of them may have to do with tangible property. Others may have to do with a person's conduct that doesn't have anything to do with either of those immunity-waiving circumstances. But yet, I don't think that in that kind of litigation, you divide up what can be pursued against the government and what can't in the context of sovereign immunity. And if these events contribute to the same injury, if they're not divisible, I can see a case where they're divisible, but these are circumstances that are not divisible. They're different circumstances, but they come together to cause an injury, and one of those causes is an immunity-waiving event. And in that situation, the legislature has said that the employee has the right to seek this substitution.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.